Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Our mission, as always, is to cut through all that noise, boil down the key insights from, well, a whole stack of sources, and give you that shortcut to being really informed. Today, we're tackling something huge, something that shapes our world often without us even noticing, globalization and economic integration. We've got some excellent material you shared, and we're ready to, you know, dig in.
Yeah, it's fascinating stuff because these ideas, they can sound really abstract, can't they? But they're actually the invisible threads pulling the strings on, well, everything from your coffee price to the jobs available nearby. Understanding it helps connect so many dots.
Totally agree. So let's start right at the beginning. We hear globalization all the time. It's everywhere. But what does it actually mean? Like, beyond the buzzword.
Okay, so at its heart, globalization isn't just, you know, stuff crossing borders. It's really this accelerating integration, this interdependence of economies, societies, cultures globally. Think of it like a web, right? Spreading out, getting denser. And it's driven by trade, investment, capital flows, people moving, and obviously the huge explosion in technology. It's basically blurring those old national lines, reshaping the whole world economy.
Okay, so much bigger than just economics. It touches culture, politics, everything. But if it's this massive force, what lit the fuse? I mean, what really kicked it into high gear? Our sources must point to some key drivers, right? It didn't just happen.
Exactly. It wasn't spontaneous. There were several big shifts, kind of a perfect storm, that let globalization really take off.
And the sources really break these down. One huge factor was the reduction in trade barriers. Big time. You know, countries used to protect everything with tariffs, quotas, but then agreements, often led by groups like the WTO, started taking those walls down, piece by piece. Plus, you saw all these free trade areas, regional blocks, popping up, actively pushing for easier trade.
Yeah, and working right alongside that, almost inseparable, is just the sheer power of technological advancement. I mean, think about transport, the container ship. Huge difference. I mean, shipping way cheaper, faster. Air freight opened things up too. Mm-hmm. But the real game changer, IT.
Yeah.
The internet, mobile phones. Suddenly you could coordinate complex global operations instantly. Distance just sort of melted away.
It's wild. A factory here managing production over there seamlessly. Because of tech, then there's the whole liberalization of markets thing. We saw this massive global shift, right, towards free markets. Countries that were closed off, state-run economies, they started opening up, welcoming foreign direct investment, FDI, cutting back regulations. It created this huge opportunity.
And that directly feeds into the rise of multinational corporations, MNCs. These aren't just companies selling stuff everywhere. They operate everywhere. Factories, R&D, sales, all over the globe.
Mm-hmm.
They're absolutely crucial because they're the ones actually moving the technology, the capital, the management know-how around the world.
Mm-hmm.
They literally weave economies together.
They really are the embodiment of it all. And that weaving, it goes straight into financial markets too, doesn't it? The sources stress this, how global capital markets now let investment just flood across borders, stock exchanges, international banks. They're like the central nervous system for funding everything, everywhere. Money doesn't really see borders anymore.
Right. And one last piece, you can't forget the political factors. You know, countries deciding to cooperate more. International bodies like the UN, the IMF, the WTO, they help grease the wheels. And regional groups too, like the EU or ASEAN, they actively foster this integration. And fundamentally, you need relatively peaceful relations between countries for this kind of deep economic collaboration to even happen, let alone thrive.
Okay, so those are the engines driving it. But like you said, it's complex. Globalization isn't just sunshine and roses. It creates winners, but also others. It has a real shadow side.
Absolutely. When you dig into the consequences, it's a very mixed bag, sometimes even contradictory. On the positive side, the stuff everyone talks about. Businesses get access to way bigger markets,
right,
which isn't just about selling more. It means scale, efficiency, bringing costs down, changes whole industries.
And for us, the consumers, that often means lower prices and more choice.
Right.
More competition, more imports. That's usually good. And it can create a lot of jobs and boost economic growth, especially in developing nations. New industries, new opportunities. We've seen that lift regions out of poverty.
Definitely. And another big plus, technology and knowledge transfer.
Mm-hmm.
Developing countries get access to modern tech, better ways of doing things, best practices from elsewhere. Plus that foreign direct investment we mentioned. It's not just money. It often brings better infrastructure, creates jobs directly.
So yeah, lots of clear upsides, tangible benefits. But the flip side, what are the downsides the sources point to? The less comfortable truth.
Well, unfortunately, there are significant ones. A major concern is inequality. Globalization can create huge wealth, yes, but the sources really highlight how it often gets concentrated. It can widen the gap between rich and poor, both within countries and between them. It's not just the rich getting richer, but maybe skilled labor and capital benefiting way more, leaving others behind. That causes real tension.
Yeah, you can see how that plays out socially and politically. And then there's the loss of cultural identity worry. You know, global brands, global media.
Yeah.
Everywhere. Does that push out local traditions, local languages, make everything kind of the same?
That's a real fear for many. And connected to the industrial expansion is environmental degradation. More production, more shipping. It means more pollution, bigger climate change impact. That affects everyone, everywhere. And sometimes, tied to that, is the risk of exploitation of labor. Workers in poorer countries might face bad conditions, low pay, because companies are chasing the lowest costs in global supply chains. And lastly, it makes economies more linked, so they become more vulnerable to global shocks. A crisis in one place, financial, pandemic, whatever, spreads like wildfire now.
Okay, so it's this really complex picture, benefits and serious risks. So when countries do decide to formally link up their economies, how does that actually look? It's not just one thing, right? It's more like steps.
Exactly. Think of economic integration like climbing a ladder. Each step up means deeper ties, building on the one before.
All right, let's climb it. Step one.
The first rung is usually a free trade area, an FTA. The key thing here, member countries get rid of tariffs and quotas on each other's goods, trade freely within the group. But, and this is crucial, each country keeps its own trade policy with countries outside the FTA. USMCA, the US, Mexico, Canada deal, that's a classic example, gives you internal free trade, but external independence.
Okay, so free trade inside the club, but you make your own rules for dealing with everyone else. Got it. What's next? Step two.
Next up is a customs union. This takes the FTA free trade among members and adds a really important layer. Common External Tariff, or CET. This means all the countries in the union agree to charge the same tariffs on goods coming in from outside the bloc. Mercosur in South America is often cited here. It means they act more like a single unit when trading with the rest of the world.
Ah, okay, so they're not just trading freely inside, they're presenting a united front to the outside world, tariff-wise. That must simplify some things, like checking where goods really came from.
It does. It mostly gets rid of the need for those complicated rules of origin you need in FTAs. But the trade-off is real. Countries give up some control over their own specific trade deals with non-members.
Right, less autonomy. So going even deeper, maybe the most talked about form is the monetary union.
Correct. This is a huge step. It means adopting a common currency and having a single central monetary authority, like a shared central bank.
Mm.
So you get one monetary policy for the whole group, same interest rates, same control over money supply. The Eurozone is the obvious example. Many EU countries sharing the euro.
Wow, yeah, that's a massive commitment. I mean, getting rid of exchange rate swings must make trade and pricing super easy between members.
Mm-hmm.
But giving up your own monetary policy, that sounds risky. What if one country's booming and another's in recession?
That's exactly the challenge. Those asymmetric shocks, as economists call them. It's really hard to manage when different parts of the union need different medicine, but you only have one policy tool. Unless you have ways to transfer funds or much deeper fiscal ties, it's tough.
Okay, so is there a level beyond that, like the absolute maximum integration?
Well, theoretically, yes. That's a full economic union. This is the deepest level. It includes everything we've talked about, free trade, common external tariff, common currency, single monetary policy, and it adds harmonization of fiscal policies, taxes, spending, and maybe even shared political institutions, like a common parliament. Shared regulations across the board.
So total economic alignment. And the closest thing we have in reality is probably the European Union, even if it's not fully there yet.
Exactly. The EU is the most advanced example, striving towards many aspects of a full economic union. The upside is potentially huge.
Mm.
Deep coordination, stability, efficiency, maybe stronger political unity. But the downside is equally huge. A major loss of national sovereignty. And it's incredibly complex and politically difficult to actually achieve and manage.
Okay, so we've covered the forms integration can take. Now, as we start to wrap up, there are two really critical concepts for judging if these integration efforts actually work out well, economically speaking. Trade creation and trade diversion. Sounds like the bottom line.
They really are. They help us evaluate whether joining a bloc is genuinely beneficial. Let's start with trade creation. This is the good stuff. It happens when forming or joining a bloc causes a country to shift its purchases from a less efficient, higher-cost domestic producer to a more efficient, lower-cost producer within the bloc.
So you join the club, and now you can buy something cheaper and maybe better from your new club partner instead of making it less efficiently at home.
Precisely. Like, say, country A makes its own widgets for $10. Country B, in the same new block, makes better widgets for $8. After joining, country A stops making its expensive widgets and imports the cheaper ones for B. That's trade creation. It means resources are used more efficiently, consumers get lower prices, competition increases. It's generally a win for economic welfare.
Right, that makes total sense. More efficient allocation. But then there's trade diversion. That name alone sounds less good.
It often is. Trade diversion happens when joining a bloc causes imports to shift away from a more efficient, lower-cost producer outside the bloc to a less efficient, higher-cost producer inside the bloc. Why? Simply because of the preferential treatment, like zero tariffs for members. But tariffs still apply to outsiders.
Ah, so you join the club, and now you're forced, or at least incentivized, to buy from a less efficient club member because the truly cheapest option from outside the club has become artificially expensive due to tariffs.
Exactly that. Imagine country A used to buy fantastic grain from country C, outside the block, for $100 a ton. Country C is the world's best producer. But A joins a customs union with country B. Country B produces the same grain, but less efficiently, for $110 a ton. Because C's grain now faces a tariff entering the union, while B's grain is tariff-free, country A starts buying the more expensive grain from B. That's trade diversion. It's inefficient globally, can annoy your old trading partners like C, and might actually reduce overall welfare for country A, even though it's in this new bloc.
Wow. So the big question for any trade bloc is whether the gains from trade creation are bigger than the losses from trade diversion.
That's the crucial calculation. If trade creation dominates, the bloc is likely enhancing overall efficiency and welfare. But if trade diversion is the main effect, the bloc might actually be harmful overall, more about protectionism than genuine economic benefit.
Okay, so pulling this all together, we've gone from defining globalization to its causes, the good and bad consequences, the different ways countries integrate, and now this critical trade creation versus diversion test. What's the big takeaway for you listening to this? Why does understanding all this matter?
Well, I think it matters hugely. In this world that's just getting more and more interconnected, understanding these forces isn't just for economists. It gives you the tools to look critically at world events, at policy debates about trade deals or international cooperation. It helps you see the potential benefits, but also the potential costs and who might bear them. It helps design better strategies, hopefully ones that share the gains more widely.
So as we leave you with this deep dive, here's something to think about. As countries keep trying to manage globalization, how do they find the right balance? That balance between getting the real economic benefits, the efficiencies of integration, and holding on to things people also value deeply: national control, cultural uniqueness, maybe just local decision-making in a world that feels increasingly globalized. That's the ongoing challenge, isn't it?